Now, this is all, as it were, introductory, and is intended to draw attention to the fact that we ought to try to understand Buddhism as a whole, in all its aspects, in all its parts, and to see these parts as integrated into a perfect, as it were, system. The great Western philosopher Hegel said, the truth is the whole. So what we're going to try to do this morning is to place Buddhism itself in the broadest possible context and to see it in the most far-reaching perspective. And this context, of course, has to be one which is familiar to the modern mind, so that we have a better chance of understanding Buddhism itself. Now, if there's anything that strikes us about Buddhism, it is that it's a very vast subject indeed. There's a great deal of it. It's very difficult to get round it all. Buddhism covers an enormous area of human experience. So that when we speak of finding a context for Buddhism itself, we mustn't take this expression too literally. It isn't like finding a big box into which we can put a smaller box. What we really mean when we speak of finding a context for Buddhism is finding a principle which is in the first place sufficiently familiar to the modern mind as not to require much explanation, if any, which appears more or less obvious or self-explanatory, and two, which is capable of being generalized in such a way as to provide a medium for the exposition of Buddhism. In other words, what we require, what we're looking for, is a universal principle of which, within its own field, Buddhism is or will be an exemplification. And at the same time, by the inclusion of Buddhism, the significance of that principle itself will be more fully revealed. Now, so far as I can see, there's only one principle of modern knowledge, or only one principle known to the modern mind, which is capable of functioning in this way. And that is the whole concept, this very important modern concept of evolution. It is so familiar, in a way, that I need not say, perhaps this morning, very much about evolution itself or evolution in general. We know, of course, now, we realize now that evolution, the doctrine or theory of evolution, was not discovered by Darwin. It was anticipated by a number of thinkers, by Kant, by Hegel, and others, according to some even by Aristotle himself. But Darwin was the first to trace the operation of this principle of evolution in detail within a particular field of knowledge, i.e. within the field of biology. And since then, the ramifications of this evolutionary principle have been discovered to extend throughout the universe. That evolution is a general concept. Evolution applies to everything, not just to life, not just to living forms, not just to biology, but evolution is a universal principle. And therefore we find Julian Huxley writing that the different branches of science combine to demonstrate that the universe in its entirety must be regarded as one gigantic process, a process of becoming, of attaining new levels of existence and organization, which can properly be called a genesis or an evolution. So we see that this concept of evolution covers the whole of life, the whole of existence. The whole of life, the whole of existence is not just existing, it's at the same time evolving. So man is a part of the universe. Man is a part of nature. Man is not something separate, not something apart from the rest of creation, as the theistic religions usually teach. So inasmuch as man himself is a part of existence, a part of nature, man himself also comes under the operation of this great process of becoming. Man himself is in process of attaining new levels, not just new forms of existence and organization. Man himself is an evolving and developing being. Now, any evolving phenomenon, anything that evolves at all, anything that develops, that grows, can be studied in two different ways. We can study this evolving phenomenon in terms of its past and in terms of its future, in terms of what it was, the origins out of which it grew, and in terms of what it will be or can be, that towards which or into which it can grow. In other words, we can study any evolving phenomenon in terms of its origins and in terms of its destination or its goal. The first method of study, or the first method of explanation, is called the genetic, in terms of origins. And the second is called the teleological, in terms of purpose, in terms of aims, in terms of goal. So suppose we take this phenomenon man, with which, of course, we are comparatively familiar. And suppose we take this phenomenon man at the very best that we know him. Suppose we take the self-conscious or aware human being. Suppose we take someone who is intelligent, perhaps of above average intelligence, who is sensitive in the sense of being aware of the reactions and the responses of other human beings, sensitive so far as nature is concerned, responsive to nature, and also ethically responsible, morally responsible. So if we take such a human being, man at the best that we know him, this self-conscious or aware human being, we find that we can look at him in two ways, or we can try to understand him in two ways. We can try to understand him in terms of what he has developed out of, and also in terms of what he will or can develop into, or in fact, what he is in process of developing into.